Hi everybody, my name is Ashley and I am alcoholic. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And I want to introduce the speaker tonight, and he's a guy who has saved and is saving my life. We have the dubious distinction, or maybe not so dubious, of both being kicked out of the same treatment center. So we have some things in common, and maybe y'all do too. My life is richer for having Daryl in it, and I want to introduce y'all to Daryl V.
Hi, I'm Daryl. I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to take this jacket off, but I did wear it, and I've got a tie on. I heard somebody say one time they wear a suit showing respect for those that came before and then something else. But all those reasons, that's why I wore it. Other people wear them, and I wore it also. It's been a great day. You know, I met with the sponsee, Brian, today, and we went through working with others, and it's just, I've had a couple of wild months. I decided, without talking to anybody, that I needed to do something different as far as work was concerned, and so I took this job. You have to be there at 4 in the morning. And it sounded good on paper. On paper, it looks good. You get there at 4, and you get out at 12, and you got all this time. But it turned out I was just horrible at this job. Things come in, lots and lots of groceries come in on these big pallets, and you're supposed to move them around and get them organized. I didn't know how to do that. It just looked like too much stuff to me, but anyway. So I had to get somebody to help me. It just looked like I needed to tell the truck driver to just go on and take it somewhere else. But anyway, I'm back at what I've been doing. I'm very happy about it, and I found out. But I did my best. I went in there and I showed up on time, and I did the best, even though I wasn't good enough. But anyway, before coming over here, I'd just tell you this: I was eating at Galaxy with a lot of other older people, and that's who eats at 5:30. And my foot fell asleep, and I got up and I fell over, and everybody came over and helped me up. It was great. I just thought I'd tell you that. I just fell right over. That's the first time in my life I've just fell over. And I guess that's just that's how those older people break their hips and stuff. They just fall over. But anyway, let's get to doing something. I'm going to read something, and then I'm going to start my story, because I thought about it, and it's just me. It turned out to be the reason I stayed in here for years and years and years and could not get sober. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the truth from the false. For them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks they see others taking with impunity. That means without harm. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over. Unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. And that's been my story from the absolute beginning up until 6/11/07, when I finally did have a psychic change when I begged God for help. But anyway, I was born in, I was born in McMinnville, Tennessee. My parents, my father and mother both, they worked in this little movie theater, and my father really liked movie theaters. My father was a cool dude. I mean, he came off of the farm up in this around this place called Dover, Tennessee, and he was a hard-working guy. He was in a family about 8 or 9 brothers and sisters, and they knew what it was like to go without food. I mean, there was other people that had food. They could have gone and got it, but they just had so much pride they didn't have anything to eat, and they refused to ask anybody for help, and that's just the way it was for them. So his brothers and sisters were upwardly mobile people, and they worked their butts off to get what they had. And but anyway, he wanted to get involved in a drive-in. He wanted to get one. Didn't have the money, but my uncle loaned him the money. And anyway, when I was 3 months old, we all went to Columbia, Tennessee. So I don't remember anything about McMinnville, but it's a pretty place though if you're ever up that way. But I grew up in Columbia, Tennessee. It's about 35, 40 miles south of Nashville. It's a great little town. But anyway, as far back as I can remember, I mean, there was just my father, because of his situation, the movie theaters and drive-ins made money in two times. They made it back then. They made money in the summer, and they made money in Christmas. And when it wasn't summer and Christmas, it looked like you're going to go broke. And he was pretty positive of it. And every time when the good times were over, he just got in this deep depression. We're going to end up in a ditch. You know, we're just not going to make it. I'm just absorbing all this. We're not going to make it. What the hell am I going to do? we're going to be in a ditch. I don't know where he got that, but that's what he said. We're going to end up in a ditch. And I was terrified. I don't know why a ditch. I don't know what the deal is with that. But that's what he said. We're all going to. And so there was a lot of fear. I grew up in this fear of we're not going to make it. But summer or Christmas would come around again, the bills got paid, and everything got better. As a matter of fact, he got real better. He was very good at what he did, and he worked real hard for it. But I liked that whole deal. I liked, he had a business, and he was out at night, and I liked it too, because I didn't want to get up in the morning, which makes me wonder why I took that job I was telling you about. But anyway, I liked the idea of us all staying up at night, and so basically we had sitters and stuff, and I would take off. We lived about a mile and a half from the drive-in. I'd go out to the drive-in, and I loved it. I mean, there's a lot of commotion going on. It was people, you know, the strange thing, what intrigued me as far back as I can remember in drive-ins, on the last three rows, there would be beer cans and whiskey bottles and condoms and all this stuff. And I knew that whatever they were doing back there was just fascinating to me. That was fascinating. That's where I wanted to be. I wasn't quite sure what was going on, but I knew there was a lot of taboo, and that's where I wanted to go. I wanted a car. So I wanted a car real young, because you can't go to a drive-in without a car. It's not going to work. So I wanted a car way before I ever had a car, and because I had a need for it. But it was a great life. And, you know, I remember when I was a kid, like on the weekends or even during the week, I would go by all these houses and all the lights were turned out. And I thought, man, I'd rather be dead than be asleep at 9 at night, you know, because I was out running around and I just loved that. But the one thing about me, it just, I don't know, but I'm pretty sure I was born an alcoholic. I say that because we got a couple of other alcoholics in our family. We did at the time. They're both dead now of this disease. I had a cousin, and he was probably the worst. Back in the early 60s, and I guess the 50s too, if you were an alcoholic, you didn't get to go to a treatment center. What they did, they put you in Tennessee, it was Central State, and they would put you in there, give you some chemicals, and they'd give you shock treatments. and because of these shock treatments, you would get better for a little while. And so they would take him and they'd give him these shock treatments. He lived in Dover, and he would come down, and he'd get these shock treatments, and so he would get a little bit better. And I loved it when Joe Bailey came to town, because I knew everybody's going to be up late, there's going to be police coming over. It was just a hoot. And my uncle was a doctor, and he was also an alcoholic. But the thing about being a doctor in the early 60s, I mean, if you're at the hospital all the time delivering babies, and you've delivered everybody in town, you just pretty much had a license to do whatever you wanted to do. I mean, he would park in the middle of the street. The police would carry him home. It was just, it finally killed it. The disease killed it. But anyway, we had some alcoholics in our family, and my father spotted it in me real early, because I was just one of those kids. I needed help to go to sleep. I needed, if I'm going to sleep, you need to give me something. Then I'll go to sleep. I just needed to readjust my system to be able to sleep, and I couldn't do that. I just never was sleepy. And so I had insomnia as far back as I could remember. And I mean, when I look back on it, I think, you know, I was at the drive-in drinking Cokes full of caffeine. So I'm sure that had a little bit to do with it. But who knew back then? But anyway, it was a good life. I was very grateful. My father, who knew what it was like to go hungry, started making quite a bit. You know, he bought a couple of more theaters, and I didn't know anything about going hungry, and my mom didn't either, and she wasn't listening to him, and I started not listening to him either, and you know, we were happy because there was, you know, there was plenty of cash, and that was convenient later on when I did find something to get to sleep that I could buy. But anyway, I'm in this state where it's sort of a mental state where if I'm over there, I need to get over here, and if I'm over here, I need to get over there. And I was a real hyper kid, and I could get on your nerves, and I did get on people's nerves. I was just like that. I was just full of lots of anxiety, and anyway, I remember in the first grade, I was really terrified to go with all these kids at the first grade, and I was in trouble an hour after I was there. And what I really wanted to do was keep a low profile. I wanted to have a low profile and not cause any trouble and sort of blend in. But the minute I get to over there in the first grade, I'm in trouble and out in the hall. And this is about the few things I remember in my early grade. But the principal and this woman walk over to me, and they say, "Are you in that class?" And I told them, I said, "No, I'm right here." And I was being serious about it. But I sort of noticed. I just was, I just opened my mouth and I'm a smart ass. I was sort of fascinated with it, that I had the ability to do that. And so I went through school, and I always got the feeling those people didn't really know me or understand me. Because what I was, like for instance, in the seventh grade, I was voted most carefree. We had these superlative things, you know. We had that one year, and I got voted carefree, and it was a shock for me because I worried about everything. Everything. I worried about you not liking me. I wondered why that guy that walked down the hall, he didn't say anything to me. I worried about being in a ditch with the rest of the family. I was terrified of life and everything in it, and they think I'm carefree. I guess it was because I acted carefree, and you know, the way I acted seemed to not have anything to do with what was actually going on inside of me. I guess that's why you got comedians killing themselves, and people are wondering, well, they're depressed. But anyway, I was terrified of alcohol. My father really instilled that in me. I mean, listen, I'll get you a car when you're 16 if you just don't drink. If you just, you're not going to be able to do it. He just knew I was one of those that was just going to have a big problem with alcohol. And I was fine with that. I didn't want to drink. Because my mother had these she had some medicine. Well, I had some medicines that were sort of, she had these prescription nose drops. I don't know what was in them, but I discovered if I could sneak in there and get those out of her closet and take a wad of those, I could get to sleep. And I also discovered there was paregoric. Paregoric, you used to be able to, I don't know if you remember, you could just buy it over the counter in a drugstore, and it for a little while anyway. But anyway, I didn't feel like I needed a drink. I'd never had a drink. It certainly wasn't in the family. Nobody drank in front of anybody. In alcoholic families, you don't see people drinking in front of each other. It's all hid. It's all under. Like my grandfather, he had a big problem with it also, and nobody ever saw him drink. He hid it in a barn. He would go to the barn and drink. But anyway, it wasn't in the family. There was no reason for me to drink. It certainly wasn't at the drive-in except on the back where he rode. And I was fine with that, and I didn't think I would drink. But that day did come, you know, when these kids, some friends of mine, everybody had 2 quarts of beer, you know, and I'm terrified. But you know, I went anyway because they're going. They got the beer, and I decided to go too. But I was really scared to death, and we all went up on this hill. And I drank 1 quart, and then I drank the next one, and just some magical stuff happened. For the first time in my, that's actually the first time in my life where I was actually still enough to watch the stars and see how beautiful they were. That experience for me was as spiritual as anything I've ever run into, and including 9 years ago. It was absolutely a spiritual experience. Everything that was wrong with me, all the fear, all the, I got to get over there, and I didn't have to get over there anymore. I was fine right where I was. I was fine with these guys. I could think, and I started asking girls out. I was so hyper, they didn't like me much. But anyway, I started, you know, and I had a big solution. I mean, it absolutely did everything I needed to do. And for about a year with alcohol, I didn't have any problems with it. I guess it's the way heroin addicts are with heroin. It brought me euphoria. Yeah, absolute euphoria, and just quelled all my problems, it seemed like. And it, unfortunately, and that's a dirty trick with alcoholism, and it's just, it works in the very beginning so good to give up on you. It's like one of these great marriages, it just turns to crap. You know, you got a beautiful woman, everything's good, and then a few years later, just awful. But that's the way alcohol was. It, you know, I started, you know, but it did so much for me. I wasn't about to give it up. And I started having to live with the consequences. I had to live with the blackouts. The blackouts are what started coming. I went through this blackout period. I was living in Knoxville with my first wife, and I was going through, it was a blackout period / pee in the bed. I blacked out, and I was peeing in the bed. I mean, everybody knew, when you're in an apartment and you're peeing in the bed, everybody knows because you have to drag the mattress out. It's like, hey, Daryl! peeing in the bed. But anyway, something happened in the middle of that wasn't so funny. I punched her out in a blackout. And as far as I know, me and her had never even had an argument. I loved this girl. But on that particular night, I turned into somebody else and I punched her out. And I came to, and I looked at her, and she had her eye, and her eye was swollen. I said, I'm going to stop. I'm so sorry. I don't remember anything. And I meant it. And I started going to AA meetings in Knoxville. But you know, it's just like what I read. Just because I decided to stop and with this alcoholism thing, it didn't matter. It didn't matter what I did. It didn't matter what kind of consequences came up. It didn't matter if I was going to meetings. Nothing mattered because I was going to drink again. I managed, and I put a lot of work into not drinking. I mean, if I don't know if you've ever tried to just, I'm not going to drink. It's a lot of work because you're so sick. You're doing other sick stuff all the time. Right? But anyway, I managed to put together about 6 months, and then but I can't win with this thing. I never could win with it because I've got this allergy. If I drink, I just keep drinking until I pass out or go into a blackout. And then I also keep drinking until I become physically addicted to alcohol and I got to go to a hospital. Don't take me to an AA meeting to see me drunk. Please take me to the hospital because that's where I got to go. I have to go get this out, be hospitalized. I mean, that's just the way it's been for the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years. And if I wasn't drinking, I obsessed on it all the time until finally I would rationalize and justify. How would it come to me? I wouldn't be drinking and I would sit there at night, you know, and I would have these aha moments. It's like, hey, I can drink only between 10 and 1. And if I do that, I'll never drink except between 10 and 1, and it's not going to affect me that much. I'll just force myself to only drink between, of course, it's like 10 to 10 when you're thinking it. But anyway, and then I'd start back, you know, and it didn't matter that I'd punched this wife out. You know, I used to say I loved her so much, my first wife. Well, I loved alcohol more. And I really know what they were saying in those treatment centers, and many of them I went to, that I loved it more than anything else because I did. I had to have it more than anything else in the world because the longer I went without it, the more screwed up I was. You know, I would ask, you know, that's another thing. I would ask them in these treatment centers, you know, how long does it take for your brain to come back and be able to think correctly? And they would always say something like 5 years. And that was sort of a key thing. If I can go 5 years, I'm going to hit some kind of normal state. And I actually sort of did that. And I wasn't even anything close to normal. My life was absolutely insane. But anyway, where was I? And so finally my first wife left me, and she was a wonderful person, and she looked at me, she says, I love you, but I can't take it anymore. And I didn't have anything to say. I mean, I understood exactly she couldn't take it anymore because there was absolutely no telling what I was going to do next. And there was no telling what I was going to do once I started to drink. And drinking, it was no more euphoria. It was becoming a nightmare. And then I was just having to deal with the consequences. A lot of people would stop then. I did not. Because still, it was the only answer I had for this condition. And my condition is alcoholism. And it's terrible. But anyway, I kept messing around with it. After she did leave me, I decided to do something. I went to this place in Nashville. It's called, Parthenon Pavilion. The psychiatrist put me over there. It turned out he was an alcoholic too, but that's another story. But anyway, he put me in Parthenon Pavilion. I stayed in there about 12 days. And the first thing I told him, I said, well, if I can't drink, I'm not going to be able to sleep. I'll be in here awake the whole time. And they said, oh, you'll sleep. And they were right. They fixed me up good. That was one of the fond memories, one of those treatment centers I sort of had fond memories of, you know. They gave me this concoction to drink before I went to bed. It completely knocked me out. What they did back then in Parthenon Pavilion, while they're taking you off of the alcohol, they give you a bunch of Librium. And so that Librium really calmed me down. And the whole time I'm thinking, yeah, I should have been taking these. And so what they mean to do is give you a bunch of Librium so you won't go into seizure, and then wean you off of it and let you go, and then you'd be sober. But I didn't take it like that. What I saw was, I don't have to drink. I can take these pills. And I went straight to my uncle, who was an alcoholic anyway. He certainly, you know, he's already taking massive amounts of them. And so I remember I could get 125 milligram Librium for like $6. It was good value. So, and if you took too many, you just call them and say, you know, I lost some Librium. I don't know what happened to them. And so for about 3.5 years, I was just eating Librium like candy. But like any, you know, I'm an alcoholic, and just like everything else, if I take one now, and I'm going to be all right. 3 weeks from now, I need two. In 3 weeks from that time, I need three, and then I need four, and then it goes on and on. And by the time, it was odd. I was running around with these alcoholics. And I was going to bars with them, and I was telling people I was an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. You know, you don't have to drink. You know, if you got a problem with it, come talk to me. I wanted to help people, and so I smoked pot, and I took these pills, and I told people about alcohol. And then one night, out of the blue, we're sitting in Nashville at the TGI Fridays, and I'm just sitting there, and out of the blue, I said, "I want a gin tonic," and then everybody's looking at me like, "What?" I said, "Yep, that's what I want." And so I started drinking on top of all these Librium. Now, my uncle had mentioned that, don't do that. and so I started drinking, you know, it carried me right back. I didn't have to drink as much, but I started drinking a lot. And that's when I went, in May 9th, 1989, I got dumped into a place in Nashville called Cumberland Heights, and I was in bad shape. The longer I was in Cumberland Heights, the more I was hallucinating. They sort of didn't get all the picture of what I was doing, and finally, they had, on one day after I was seeing all kinds of things that I shouldn't be seeing that weren't really there, They just started giving me massive doses of phenobarb, and that was a serious treatment center. That's absolutely the worst detox I've ever had. They took me to the psychiatrist, and I said, "Well, how long is this going to last?" He said, "About a year." "You don't need to be out for about a year. You need to be in some place." And I said, "Ah, it's going to be all right." But I got willing in there. I was willing to do anything they told me to do. I was willing to go to a halfway house, and I was defeated. Alcohol and these pills had defeated me, and I was a yes man, you know. I tell you something about when you take a lot of Librium for a long period of time, you can't perform. Anyway, I couldn't perform, and I thought in my head, it's gone. I'm never going to have that again. It's gone away. And then one day in the shower at Cumberland Heights, I discovered, well, it's not gone. It's coming back. And there's another psychic change I had. They're again talking to me about, "Well, you can go to this. We're looking for you a place to go." And I said, "Go where?" I said, "I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to be here for 30 days and I'm leaving. You know, I'm not going to a halfway house." Even knowing that I'll probably hallucinate for a year, never. As far as I'm concerned, I'm cured. Because I could date. I'll let her drive. But anyway, I got out and I went to AA meetings, and I dated in AA, and it was one disastrous, horrible thing after another. I seemed to have an absolute knack for finding somebody just as sick as me, and I could do that. And it didn't matter how many alcoholics were in there; I could find that one woman who's probably going to stab you. Eventually the chaos from that, and the chaos from the strained relationships, and all the chaos I was going through, I would drink again, and so I'd go through this whole deal, and finally I went to Cumberland Heights 3 times within about a 3-year period of time. They told me I couldn't come back. You can only go to some of these places like 3 times, evidently. I guess it makes them look bad, even if you and their insurance has run out. But anyway, I still couldn't quit, and I was going in and out of hospitals. I mean, not routinely, but I would try to make them at least detox like once a year. I thought if I could just detox once a year, that's not bad. and insurance would pay for it also. If you could just keep that, you know, that detox down to once a year. But anyway, I was going to hospitals, no more treatment centers. I was going to hospitals and the emergency rooms, and uh, And I finally, because of I was taking some other things with the alcohol, and I almost hit a school bus about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I decided that I better quit because there was a lot of people pissed off at me, I mean, the entire town. And so I did. I put together an AA that 5 years they kept telling me about. But the longer time went by, the whole 5 years was just a series of... what it looked like to me when I wasn't drinking, it looked like every day there's a darker cloud following me around. It was just this depression, and it's just this dark cloud, and I can't get away from it. It's just, and every day it got worse. It got a little darker. It just seemed like my depression got darker, and alcohol would fix that immediately. But anyway. I did, because of this horrible trouble I got into, and because I stopped drinking for a while, and what happened to me, I was in a convenience store, and there was this girl in front of me, and she had a halter top on, and she reaches in, pulls out some money, and I thought, boy, that's cool. And so I asked her out, and it turns out she smoked crack and sold it. And so I go on this, I shouldn't be talking about drugs, but I am, and I'm sorry. I can't leave big chunks of things out. I don't know how to talk cool in there. But anyway, that's what happened to him. I mean, nobody even smokes it anymore. I think it's out of form now. Everybody's on meth or something. But anyway, heroin. But anyway, back then, that's what it was. And I got on that, and I really liked it at first. It just, you know, but my life changed overnight. It was one of those spiritual experiences again. I just, as long as I had that stuff, I could be happy. But what I can tell you is whatever money you got, whatever houses or anything, it just went fast. It's like alcohol. It's like in super speed. It's just, everything goes real fast. It's just all of a sudden, within about a 6 or 7 month period of time, all the cash was gone. The drug dealer came with a U-Haul and took my furniture. And I had a Sea-Doo, motorbike, and car. Gone, and I'm living in my drug dealer's mother's house, but in Nashville, and it was pretty quick. But anyway, I sort of liked it. I could look out the window, and there's prostitutes running around, drug dealers. It's sort of what you need, except it's being a crackhead is not very good if you don't have any money. If you don't have any money, you're just a crack. You're a crack wanter. You just want it. And I wasn't adapted. I mean, people would tell me you need to get a scam. You need to get a hustle, dude. And with me, it's the same as the receiving thing. I just didn't know. I don't know how to make any money out of it. I can't make money out of nothing out here. But anyway, I got back to Clinton. There were some people. There was a few people who still had a little bit of. I don't know if they had hope. They were willing to help me, and that's how I ended up in Atlanta. They shipped me down here because of that, and because I went to this place, and they keep you a long time, and that's a lot of people back home want them to be gone a long time. So I came down here, and I went to this place called Mark. And I started noticing in Mar, you know, I started to see that I was absolutely hopeless because of the nature of this crack thing. I just thought about it and obsessed on it for 13 months the whole time I was there. And I thought, when is this going to go away? You know, I would partially work the steps. But, you know, I'll tell you about the steps right now. And I didn't do them, and I wouldn't do them right because I didn't think they would work. I had it in my head, they're not going to work. It's a bunch of hooey. And I wouldn't do them. I thought just going to meetings is going to help me. And I can assure you, during the story I've been telling you about, I was going to thousands of meetings. Back home, I was there all the time. It was pitiful. But And that's why I read that, you know. But anyway, I get down here, and so I managed to put together about 6 months when I get out of Mar the first time. I'm working at Starbucks. And so I start the whole thing up again. You know, one night I'm mad at the manager. And it dawns on me, I have one of those, you know, aha moments. You know, I don't know any crack dealers in Atlanta, so I can drink without smoking crack. It was that fast. And I pulled into a store and bought a 12-pack and went home. And after I drank three or four beers, I'm thinking, well, I'll find a crack dealer. So I go out to the car and take off, and I go looking, and it doesn't take a lot. If, you know, if you're looking for something like that, you can pretty much find it. They're not hiding. But anyway, that lasted about a year. I'd gotten out, and I'm right back at it again. The only difference this time, I didn't smoke with anybody. I had this habit. I would get my product, and I would get my alcohol, and I would go to these little parks down by the river, you know, and I'd go out into the woods where nobody could see me, which turned out to be an eternal nightmare because I'm always going down there. And I was smoking this stuff, and I don't know if you've ever done it, but you get real nervous and you hear things. And there's deer out there and squirrels. It was madness. So I'm doing this for about a year. I'm going jumping around every time I hear a squirrel. Just a nightmare. You know, the only thing more fun than that is peeping out the keyhole for 8 hours. But anyway, I finally got to a point where, you know, I was crashing and burning. I knew I needed help, and Mar decided to let me back in. But if you go back to the same treatment center again, they have a meeting about it, and they decide to change the way they're going to handle you, and they did that because I do real good in treatment. I'm a good treatment guy. I go and I follow the rules and play the little treatment games, and I'm nice to everybody because I want you to leave me alone. I don't want any trouble. But they weren't going to let me just slide through this time. I went over there, and they already knew I'm a con because I just, you know, lied to them for 13 months, acting like I'm ready to do something, and you know. But anyway, it didn't take them long. They're really, and when I watched myself, the more they pushed me over there, the angrier I got, and I just snapped two or three times, and I was scaring myself at what a complete prick I was if I didn't get my way, and they weren't going to let me have my way. What finally happened in Mar the last time, I told them, you know, it's funny, your whole life's over, you're 53 years old, I mean, your life, you destroyed your life, but I was worried about the oil in my car. I hadn't had an oil change, and all of a sudden I've got to get the oil changed. So I go to my counselor, I say, listen, I can't remember when I changed the oil, I got to get the oil changed. And so he just looking at me, he gave me $20. He said, you go get an oil change for that $20. And I said, well, I don't, what if it costs more? He said, you can get it with that. And so I take off and I go to this oil change place, and I see that I need a lot of the stuff that they do. So I get the like $55 or $60 special and write them a hot check. Drive back over to Barn after that. I've accomplished what I need to do. I've gotten this oil change, and I walk in and tell him, the counselor, who didn't like me much. But anyway, I told him, you know, what I had done, and I told him I'm sorry. I figured that's good enough. That's honesty. You go do what you want to do, and then come back and tell them about it. That was my honesty. But anyway, he said, well, we'll think about it for a while. And that's when this guy and those people over in Mars saved my life. Because they decided to throw my ass out of there. And I thought I was in good shape because half our community got thrown out for using dope. And I thought, well, hell, I'm not drunk. I'm not on dope. I'm okay. You know, I ain't very truthful. But anyway, he calls me in his office. He said, "You're out," and I go ballistic because you know I use these places. I need to be there as long as I need to be there, and then I go and I start doing the same thing over again. And then I come back, you know, and they weren't going to have it. I was gone, and that's it. And that's the best thing that I'd ever done. I went straight from there over to this other halfway house, which was and I stayed there for about 30 days, and that was the first time I'd actually got sort of serious about this thing. I got my sponsor, but you know there were still things, you know, and you know, I had these wild, crazy ideas like, you know, if I don't want to tell you something, what business is it yours? You know, I've got some things I'm not going to tell anybody, and it's none of your business because I'm not going to tell you. That's it. And how's that going to help me if I embarrass myself? But anyway, there was a few things I didn't want to tell him. We tried to do the steps, and managed to put together about 6 months when I got out of there. And all of a sudden, it seems like on one weekend, I just found myself sitting at the table again with some Budweiser and some when I got to Atlanta, I added Jägermeister to the mix. I don't know. I guess I saw somebody drink. But anyway, I got my Budweiser, my Jägermeister, and my crack. And so, and the phone's ringing. It's all these people in recovery, and I couldn't really. It's like, how did I end up doing this shit again? You know, I didn't even have to give it much thought. I'm just doing it. I couldn't really remember, you know, even planning it that much. I just had some spare time when I thought nobody's watching me, and I'm doing it, right? And so it was another miserable time because I can't seem to drink enough to get anything done. I'm trying to ration my crack with some low money. I don't know if you've ever done that, but that's no good. And so I'm rationing everything out, and it's just absolutely miserable. I live with my ex-wife, and she came in and looked at me. She said, "I'm gonna come in and find you dead." And I'm like, "What is the matter with you?" I'm fine. Denial. I always had a lot of denial. I mean, you know, I had this wonderful thing where I'm gonna do something tomorrow. Tomorrow, you know, I'm going to get in this AA thing, I'm going to get sober, I'm going to be happy like you guys, but not right now. It's going to come a little later. And it had been going on for years. I had this insane thing that I'm going to do something later on. But something snapped in me during that weekend that I'm never going to do anything. There is no tomorrow. This is the way I'm going to die. I'm 53 years old. I'm sitting here drinking. I'm smoking crack. And this is the way I'm going to go out because I've not been able to stop. I've gone to one of the best treatment centers in the United States, and I've stayed there for 13 months, and that didn't help. And I got kicked out not long ago. And I'm going to die. You know, dying was okay. The trouble is, I mean, you know, it's like I heard it in the song, you know, the doctor says it'll kill you, but he don't tell you when. You just seem to linger on and go on and on and on. It's just more misery. But anyway, it was absolutely just despairing weekend. I mean, it's pretty sad when you're buying all this stuff and it's not giving you euphoria. It's not giving you euphoria. It's not giving you anything. All I had, I'm just sitting there in despair with a crack pipe and Jägermeister and Budweiser, and it's not doing anything for me. And I can't seem to. And for the first time, I'm sitting there. Not only I'm worrying, you know, I don't want to worry. I mean, you want this stuff to do something, for God's sake. But anyway, in the middle of all that, I love animals because they don't tell me what to do. I had a cat, I still got a cat, and this cat got extremely sick, and I had to carry it to the vet. And the vet's like, "Its vitals are terrible, and we don't know if it's going to make it through the night." And I knew immediately right then, probably eat something that I had on the table. You know what I'm saying? And so the cat's going to die, and I'm just worthless. You know, I can't even keep an animal alive, a pet. And a cat's pretty young. They're pretty self-maintained. All you got to do is feed them. I mean, if you can't take care of a cat, come on. But anyway, It seems like in the middle of all this mess, in the middle of all this drinking and trying to get high on the crack, I said a prayer. I asked God to help this cat. I didn't ask God to take the desire to drink away. I didn't ask God to do anything else, but I begged God to save that cat. At least let that cat pull through. And I'm not going to tell you that God performed this miracle and pulled my cat through. I'm telling you my cat pulled through. And the funny thing is the next day, you know, I'm still drinking a little bit. And the next day I started doing the stuff you've been telling me to do for years. You know, instead of getting in traffic and immediately cussing out everybody on the road, I started asking God. I started talking to God. Because he's done this thing for my cat, and I feel like I need to talk to him. And so I'm talking to God all day. I'm going, and I managed to go to work, and I'm asking God when I'm getting angry. I'm doing this stuff that I didn't think worked, and I didn't believe there was a God. And in the middle of all that, in the middle of my cat getting sick, and the obsession for me to use alcohol and drugs went away. And I'm an expert. You know, I've spent 40 years doing drugs and drinking. I know when I need to go to the hospital. And one thing I knew, and I was positive of at the time, you don't just throw a drunk on a weekend and all of a sudden your desire to use is gone. You got to go through a process. You know, it's a painful little process, but it was gone. And so, it wasn't just that. It wasn't just the desire to use alcohol and drugs was gone. If I'm somewhere and you take the alcohol and drugs away, my obsession immediately turns to something else. It's like because sex and alcohol and drugs and all that stuff is the same thing. The obsession for it was absolutely the same. It did the same thing for me. And I didn't have a desire for any of that stuff. What I had a desire for is to stay sober and to do this deal. And I went back to my sponsor and I told him, I said, I know I've been a jerk off. I haven't done anything you've told me to do. But if you want to work with me, I'm going to do exactly what you tell me to do. And if a program works, that is fantastic. And if it don't, then we won't worry about it. And I did. I started working with this guy, and I did exactly what he told me to do. I met him when he told me to be there. And even after all this, though, you know, I still lied on a fifth step. I'm doing a fifth step, and there's two or three things I wouldn't care to my grave. I'm just not gonna tell anybody. But God was there for me because He looks at me. He said, "Did you leave out anything?" And I said, "No." And then He said, "You sure you didn't leave out anything?" And I said, "Yeah, I did leave something out." And so I talked for 30 minutes more, and I got it out, and it was in a park, and I walked out of there free. The first time I've ever been free, because it's always been, you know, I do when you're not looking, I do all this stuff in the shadows. You know, and that's my business. It's not your business. But today, I don't do anything in the shadows. My life is an open book. I didn't think it was possible for me to, like tonight, to go home and lay down and go to sleep without chemicals or alcohol. It was just impossible. And because of you guys, I'm able to do that. And I'm so blessed today. Once I started working the steps and doing what you guys told me to do, I started having a different class of friends. You know, I have friends today that actually give a shit about me. You know, if I listen to them, they'll tell me my head is a problem. It still is. Those people at Cumberland Heights about, you know, this whole thing about coming together, that in 5 years, well, it don't. Mine didn't. My thinking, I mean, my life's better. What I do is pretty good stuff. What I think is awful. It's just awful. Maybe it's gotten better, but I don't go, you know, when I think something, that doesn't mean I got to go run and do it. And that's the way I live life. I think it, then I run and do it. I get in trouble, and I'm sorry. I'm able to have a good life today. I've got sponsees, and you know, right now, well, both of them are better mentally off than me, but that's okay. Just absolute wonderful people. I've got great fans in the program, and today I screw up in the program, but not anything big, you know. But one thing I don't screw up is when I get up in the morning, I get on my knees and I ask God to. I don't ask Him to take my desire to use alcohol and drugs away because He's already done it, and I just never got in the habit of doing it. But I do ask Him, you run this day, because if you don't run this day, I'll run it in the ground, because I'm quite capable of being absolutely sober and just screwing this whole day up. And so far, I've been able to do that. I'm not in any trouble. I hadn't gone to jail sober. And I'm capable of doing that. The first time I was ever arrested for a felony, I had 4 months sober. It's hard to explain how all that happened, but it sure did. But anyway, it's time. Anyway, thanks for letting me talk.
We couldn't shut you down, Daryl. It was just too good. I wanted to hear what happened next.
Morning. He ain't scared of the dark. He doesn't gotta worry. But when it's all said and done, he ain't even started. But he's already done. Now it's paging Mr. Bitter. Party of one. He sees no reason to lie to you. Get him full of liquor, no telling what he'll do. Now it's all gone away, but he keeps moving from moon to sun. Now it's paging Mr. Bitter. Party of one. All around him, he ain't even got a home. ain't got nobody. No one to call his own. He's older but not wiser. No one's fault but his own. So it's paging Mr. Bitter. Party of one. Now it's paging Mr. Bitter. Party of one.